right. We are here for another episode of Going Deep. We're with John Sheehan again, partner architect, one of the brains behind what used to be SoftGrid, we now call
AppV, or AppV. Microsoft Application Virtualization.
Excellent. We had you on before, sort of the part one, so we're going to assume that all the Niners out there will go back and watch that so we can concentrate more on the architecture,
okay.
Go a little bit deeper.
Okay.
So talk to us.
So in the first part, we talked about sort of what is AppV, how would people use it, what could you accomplish with it.
Yeah.
I think it probably makes more sense now to talk about how we do what we do.
Yes.
Because that's really, we didn't get into it nearly as much as I wanted to last time.
Okay, great.
All right. So when you want to stream an application, which is what times a lot of people think of AppV as doing, there's kind of a fundamental problem, is the application was written to just install on the operating system. They have no idea that there's this thing called virtualization. They have no idea that there's this concept called streaming. And so we really had to come up with a way of being able to take an application that was already written that had no knowledge of this, and convert it into an application that that can be virtualized, streamed, and really turned into a click-to-run service, right? So the goal is there's no such thing as installation.
Excellent.
There's no such thing as, you know, having to spend a long time prepping your system before you can get your job done. So what you want to be able to do is just click on a link, and then some bits start coming down over the network, and then the app starts running. And as far as you know, it's the same experience you already, you know, you've always had. So there's a lot of different pieces to it to make that happen. The first piece is what we call the sequencing piece, and it's basically a repackaging operation. And so what we do is we have you install the application on a clean system. And we sit down underneath in the kernel, and we watch everything that the application tries to do to the system.
Okay.
All right. And so maybe I should draw
Absolutely.
That for you.
All right.
So the way it works is, you know, in AppV we always sort of have our standard. You know, there's your kernel mode, and then there's your user mode part of the system. In the kernel, we have what we call a virtual registry. In a virtual file system, a vreg and a vfs.
Okay.
And when it comes to Windows applications, usually everything that you do boils down to files on disk or registry and entries in the Windows registry. And so that's really the two biggest subsystems that we have. So if in user mode you have an installer, right? And the installer's running, what it's really doing is it's writing into the system. It's going and copying files to program files, it's registering services, it's, you know, writing to the registry and setting up its configuration. It's doing all of these different things. We sit down here and we capture all of this. And when the installation is done, we can go ahead and write it out to, you know, to a format that we call SFT. And the reason I drew it this way is because it's logically a virtual disk. So all of the files and everything that the installer does gets written into this disk, which is just a file on disk. It's very similar to a VHD, okay. But it's our own format. And the reason that we have our own format today is we optimize for the streaming process. And the way that works is when the installation is done, you sort of just, it's very simple. You kind of get this GUI and you say, I want to create a new package. You say next, it's called, you know, Visual Studio. You say next, then you go and run the Visual Studio installer. It's going off making all these changes to the system. We're capturing everything underneath. When we're done, we have everything that we need to actually run the application virtually. But what we don't have is we don't have an optimized view of the application.
Okay.
So we don't know which blocks would be the first ones that would normally get touched when you launch Visual Studio. If we don't know that, that means that the first time you go to launch Visual Studio and the bits aren't there yet, then you're going to have a slow experience because we don't know where to start the process. So we literally have to wait for page faults to come before the application, before we know that a particular block is needed. Okay. I mean, you know, Visual Studio's, you know, 5 gigabytes, 10 gigabytes, whatever it is, and
it's five, two, maybe two, no.
That's only the base one. You think about everything that it installs, and if you put all the other components in it, MSDN is kind of big. Sure. The platform SDK, you know, if you use the DDK, gets pretty big.
Which actually brings up an interesting point in the sense that if you want to minimize what you need in any particular, perhaps I want to install something, but I don't want, you know, C++ and VB, or maybe I just want C++. In other words, I can modify. You store that information for me, so I'll install Visual Studio that only has C++, for example. That's not a problem because you're going to record all of that information anyway.
Right. Exactly. So only the things that you install are going to get captured.
Perfect. I just want to be clear that you install what is happening in reality in user mode.
Exactly.
Got it. All right.
All right. So so we need to figure out what is needed in order to get that app going the first time. And we do this profiling experience where basically we say, you go ahead and launch the application, and then we will watch what you do. We'll record all those blocks, and then we will format this file such that those are the first things that come down.
Nice.
Okay. So the sequencing time process is actually pretty challenging because if it was just this, if it was just an installer, it really wouldn't be that hard of a process. But it's not just an installer. There is, you know, there's an MSI service, right? There are things like the application information service, right? Do you know what that is?
No.
It's new in Vista. It is when you say, I want to run something elevated.
Yeah.
The create process actually is an RPC call out to this guy. This guy creates the process on your behalf, elevated. Mm-hmm. The kernel hooks back up the lineage so that whatever the calling process was looks like it was the parent. And they sort of hook all that stuff up. And then when you're done, the app is running, and it's running elevated. Installers tend to do a lot of elevation because they need that elevated privilege. So on Vista, this process, you know, or this service, you know, if we don't capture what happens there, then we're going to miss a bunch of the installation and you'll have a bad package.
Okay.
And that really brings us back to sort of our fundamental technique for virtualizing applications. Because there are lots of different ways you could think of capturing what an installer does. A common one is snapshot and diff. So what you do is you scan the entire system and figure out everything that's there and its timestamp and the metadata about it. And then you say, okay, this is what the system looked like before the application's installed. You then go and run the installer.
Yeah.
And then when you're done, you go and look at every resource again and say, what's different? And then that difference is the application.
Sure.
The problem with that technique is that that's not the way that operating systems, you know, including Windows, work. When you're running the installer, that doesn't mean that's the only thing happening on the system. Just because you don't see something happening, it doesn't mean something else isn't going on.
Sure.
So if we just blindly did that and there was the search service running, and the search service started writing stuff to disk because it was, you know, it was scanning, you know, new files are getting added to the system, search kicks in and starts looking at them. Or you know, Windows Update was running, or something else, anything else that was running on the system, we would actually capture all of those changes and we would put them as part of Visual Studio. We would deploy them to a system, and then who knows, you know.
What really happened.
Right, exactly. besides the fact that you know, you could just end up with a really big package that in the best case it has a bunch of junk in it, but the junk is benign. The worst case is you capture part of the operating system, you carry it along to some other system, and the app doesn't work because you have the pre-SP1 bits of Vista in there, mm-hmm. and then the app has SP1, and then inside the, you know, inside Absolutely. The virtual environment, it just doesn't match up.
It's not a scalable. It's a bad design.
It's the most common one that we've seen by that other people do, and what they do is they try to use heuristics after the fact to clean up.
Okay.
So they say, oh, there's this thing called Windows Search, so we'll try to clean that up, and ooh, we'll try to clean that up, and maybe we shouldn't capture that. And the heuristics work okay, but you're still not as good as if you are really just capturing the installation
Absolutely.
Process. So how we have to do it is kind of funny, because what we don't want to have to tell people is everything that you do that's going to affect the system, well, you tell us and then we'll launch it, right? So what we really need to allow them to have very natural installation experience. So for example, you know, in user mode you have the shell. And a lot of the installation process starts with the shell. You know, you double click on an exe or an MSI or, you know, some other type of installation file. And, you know, and then shell calls create process and, you know, launches one, you know, one thing, or this installer really got launched by shell. You know, this is really kind of the starting point.
Sure.
So what we do is we monitor shell, which means that we wait for children from the shell process to appear. When those processes appear, we have this other component down in kernel mode called the process manager.
Sure.
This is not the Windows
process.
This is our process manager. Right. We have our own, and we tell it. So let's say the shell is PID 1234 or something. We down here we tell it that PID 1234 is an interesting process because its children should be monitored. And this guy sits down here, and as all those create processes happen, if it starts here, that's one. But there's actually another one out there, which is services.exe.
Sure.
Right? One thing that we don't do when it comes to virtualization is we try not to, or we just don't, take a process that's already running, has already interacted with the system, already has handles, already has a view of the world, and then attempt to sort of change that view on the fly. Because you don't really know that's safe. For example, you may lie to it and say that it does something like it says C:\Windows, you know, system32, foo.dll, right? It opens that. We may actually decide for virtualization reasons that exists somewhere else.
Okay.
And so we effectively lie to it. And lying is virtualization. It's true in hardware and it's true in software. You know, in hardware virtualization, the operating system doesn't know that it's running on a fake machine. In this case, it doesn't know that it's running in a fake virtual environment. And so if we try to do this to a system that was already running, it may have already opened a handle to this. It may have already expect this to be a particular version. And if later on we lied and told it a different version, well, that would be very bad. So we have to do some interesting things, like we have to shut down the MSI service. By shutting down the MSI service first and then monitoring services, if the installer is an MSI install, mm-hmm. when they launch it, the service will start up. Since we care about, or we're monitoring services.exe, now all of a sudden we see the MSI service inside the environment. We capture everything that happens from that service as well, and that's how we make sure we sort of capture everything. And so it's sort of interesting in there's tons of examples of this kind of stuff that we have to do. So there's a lot of prep work that goes into understanding how Windows works and tracking it over time, right? I mean, this didn't exist in Vista. I mean, it didn't exist in XP. And so when this didn't exist, we didn't track it.
Does that still exist? I'm assuming it still exists in Windows 7.
Yes, it does.
Sure.
Yeah, so Windows 7 is
fundamentally Vista.
It's very similar to Vista, yeah.
So let me ask a question. And a lot of developers will actually make custom installers,
mm-hmm.
right? And there's nothing special they need to do.
Nothing.
So, I mean, it could be an interesting thing where if you were like, is there a way that you could build an installer with a priori knowledge that this application is going to be virtualized?
And
it could help you guys do your job easier without having to do all of your magic.
Well, not. I mean, you could
package while I install.
So we do different things than that internally, right? So sometimes we have software that is part of the build lab. Without doing this monitoring, it basically just writes out the file. So that's one option you could do, and just say, "All right, I have my build, and now I'm just going to take and write out the files." Our customers tend to use this tool, and here's the thing. Most software in the world is not ISV software. It's not built by third parties and you go and purchase it. It's developed by internal houses. So when we go down to Wall Street, they say, we have 5,000, 7,000 applications. And you just go,
wow.
They say, oh, no, maybe 5% of that is ISV. All the rest of it's internally developed. And this internally developed software is... It's our competitive advantage. That's how we stay ahead of our competitors. So once they take this in-house, I like this scenario better, which is why write an installer ever, right? Because one thing you can do in this environment is start that process. You don't run an installer. You open up Explorer, copy files, open up regedit or import a reg file. We don't care. We're sitting down here, and it all turns into creating files and registry entries and stuff in the kernel. So we don't really care in user mode how it's happening. So you can go that route and say, you no longer have to build installers. You can just, however you as a developer, before the installer was actually written and done, would set up the files and would, get your system environment, just do that and then hit save.
Excellent.
And you've got the same thing. So that's kind of the interesting model that we've seen very often.
Mm-hmm. So, I was talking to somebody recently about the idea of, just virtualizing applications in like for CTPs, regardless of what the application is. Like the standard model that we use today is stick it into a VPC, make somebody download a 10 gig package or a 5 gig, which is I think is ridiculous. What happens to the files? Visual Studio needs to store all these files, and the next time you launch it, if it's not physically there, will those files be there? How do people save their project file? These are questions I was getting. I was like, well, I'm assuming you guys virtualize file system.
Some of the file system.
Okay.
So this is probably a good time to transition over to the client now.
Yes.
And see how it actually works.
So this is set up.
So this is set up. At this point, we have this virtual volume that contains all the resources, file and registry, and actually a key part of this process I should mention is that it's not quite this easy. And by the way, this is not easy in the end anyway, but it's actually much harder than this because what we really need to do as a next step, once they're done laying down all the resources, is we have to go and analyze the metadata to figure out what they were trying to do. So, like I said, most things on Windows boil down to registry entries and files, but there's a lot of metadata there. Like an NT service is a bunch of files and some registry entries, but it's special registry entries that I have a special form that dictate that this represents an NT service as opposed to a COM object, which is also a bunch of files and registry entries, which designates how it gets instantiated. So there's a whole lot of metadata that we have to extract at the end. We have to go through and say and figure out whether there were any services created. And we do the service creation stuff in user mode, actually. There's a bunch of subsystems that virtualize in user mode. This is a simplified view, but up here, inside this process, we have this thing we call soft loader, which does things like virtual COM. It does virtual services, or it does a piece of virtual services. It does the internal, when you make service calls, it's the thing that captures those service calls and makes sure that if you're trying to talk to a service that's not really on the system, but it's virtually, it's inside your environment, but it's not installed on the real system, the real service control manager knows nothing about it. We have a virtual service control manager. This in-process piece here is the thing that captures those requests and basically brokers the giving you the answers. So if you query for the status of the service, if we just let the scum, the service control manager, give you the answer, he would say, that service doesn't exist. Sorry, failure. You'd fail the call. We capture it and say, oh, that's a virtual service. So we have our service control manager, which handles the virtual services, answer those same questions. So as far as the application is concerned, the service is installed. It actually is running. We execute the service, and all the queries that it makes, everything works. And so we, this is where the complexity happens with virtualization, because getting this far is very complicated, especially file systems. But then there's a whole nother layer of subsystems built on top of these basic things that you have to go off and handle. You even have to handle things like fonts. So we have to virtualize fonts because the fonts aren't really installed on the system. So if you install Office and you want to virtualize it, they lay down like 100 fonts or whatever. There's a ton of fonts in there. If you then stream the app and you were using those fonts and now they're not there, you would have a bad user experience.
Sure.
So even things like fonts, we have to put in special code to make sure that inside that virtual environment, we see those fonts. But on the local system, you don't see the fonts, right?
Interesting. I mean, it just seems like, I mean, that all in the end, what that does is it sort of, you know, bloats or blows up this virtualization layer. So I was thinking when you were saying that, is there the notion of sort of a hypervisor model, but for software applications, such that you have a thinner layer of work that you have to do, and you can utilize more of what's already on the system?
There isn't, but there are techniques for doing that.
Okay.
And so we can talk about
sure.
that a little bit when we get to the client.
Cool.
So yeah, at this point right now, we have all of these files, registry, all the metadata, which is the really important piece. It's been optimized for streaming,
awesome.
and we're ready to go.
All right.
So what the administrator does is while the once this is done, they are able to copy this up to a server, a central server. And once they do that, it's now available for everyone on their network.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if we supported it the last time, but we have basically three protocols that we support for the streaming piece. So I'll start drawing out the architecture,
sure.
but while I'm doing it, I'll talk a little bit about the streaming piece because it's kind of the next logical step. In the kernel, we have, again, the virtual registry and virtual file system, and we have that process manager. This, logically for us, is a subsystem we call System Guard. So this is System Guard. And System Guard is, it sounds like a security boundary. It's not a security boundary. When we say guard, we're more saying we don't let this application change your system. So therefore, it can't break other applications by causing DLL hell. It can't, you know, break Windows because it replaced some system binary with an older one that Windows tries, you know, Windows prevents, but in older versions of Windows, they didn't have those protections. Other things that we have in the kernel is we have a file system. And this is one of the confusing things that always confuses people, because you see this box here,
yeah.
and then you see this box over here. And you say, what's the difference? Well, this is a real NT file system. It's not NTFS, but it is a file system that is written to the NT specification for building a file system. This stores files. So when we spoke before about we had this package, mm-hmm. right? That's out, you know, now it's out in the cloud somewhere. It's out on the network. You know, let's say it's Visual Studio.
Mm-hmm.
Those bits stream down to the client into our transport and eventually make their way down to the file system. So this thing does persistence, meaning that if you change a file and you write to a file, this is a file system, it handles writes to a file. That's its sort of purpose in life, or one of its purposes in life.
Okay.
This over here does not. So this is purely what they call a file system filter, and it sits in the I/O stack, and its main purpose in life is for overlaying the native file systems. So if you think you have, you know, you think of like you have like C colon. Inside of C colon, there are things like, you know, program files, right? There are all these directories, and our file system has a separate drive letter, so when you install at V, you see a new drive letter. It defaults to Q, but it can really be any available drive letter. So if anything is written or read from Q, our file system handles it.
Okay.
Right? Anything, because that's that's its drive letter. For virtual applications, a lot of times, even though you may say, I want to install over on my F drive or something, you tell Office, install over here. I don't want you to install my system drive, install over here. And you go through the GUI in the installer and you tell it to install there. And it does. It installs there, except it puts a whole bunch of stuff in your system drive anyway. It puts things in System 32. It puts things in program files, common files. And that's where it expects those things to be. If we weren't able to handle that, the app wouldn't work, because it would go into System 32 and look for a file, like OneNote has like a printer driver. If that printer driver is not there in System 32, then the app's not going to work because it expects it to be there. Or Art Gallery and Equation Editor are under common files, under program files. If it doesn't see them there, it's not going to work.
Okay.
So the job of this is basically to intercept those calls, because it's sitting in the I/O stack, and redirect them over to this drive over here. Because all of the files for the application really exist here. So we would never go and edit the C drive. We'd never go and modify the C drive and stick files there because that would break isolation. That would break the virtualization boundary, and then the application could potentially break the OS.
Understood.
Right? So we sort of have these two different things. So it's just one of the most confusing pieces whenever we draw this picture, because people always look at the two and say, they both end in FS, they both have file system in their name, what's the difference?
Okay.
All right, so let's go through the process of initially streaming the application. So the transport is one piece of a user mode component that we call, it's called the listener. We have some, you know, these are all engineering terms, right? So they, you know, the marketing team would, they would probably come up with worse terms, but sure. our terms are never particularly good for what they do. But we have this thing that is a listener, and inside it has something which is called the core. It has a piece that is system guard. It's the system guard core. It's our client core. We have this thing that's the transport. And if we take the process of launching an application, pretty much everything starts here. So the first thing that has to happen when you want to use, say, Visual Studio is typically first you want to register on the system. You want to see the shortcuts. You want to see the file type associations. You even want things like DDE entries to work because lots of apps
certainly
still use them, right? So you want the app to look and feel just like it's there. So we have to go and register the file type associations and the shortcuts and everything so that it works. When we do that, even though it has the same name, it has the same icon, it looks just like the Visual Studio icon. What it's really pointing to is a little launcher that we have. It's called our tray, but it's really a launcher process. So if you say, I'm interested in Visual Studio, and you click a button to register virtual Visual Studio, that takes like, you know, a second or two. And but you know, in 2 seconds it looks like Visual Studio is installed in your system.
Nice.
And so now it looks like it's there. You go and click on the link, and what really happens is the shell creates our launcher. And there's some additional parameters to let it know that, hey, I'm trying to launch Visual Studio versus Word versus Outlook versus Adobe Reader versus whatever.
Okay.
The tray communicates with the client core and says the user is trying to launch a particular application. And the client core is what we call the orchestration engine for the system, because all of these individual components are all very loosely coupled, meaning we can take System Guard without any other part of the system, put it on a machine, and virtualize stuff, right? We even without our file system, we could use a directory instead of our file system, or we could use a native file system instead of the virtual one. And we can run this component separately, and that's how a lot of the testing happens. Our file system, we can put just the file system on there, and then we can run the IFS kit tests at it. Even our transport, we have unit tests and functional tests that have nothing on the system except the transport, and it just deals with the network. So we have all of these loosely coupled components, and this is very intentional in our architecture, because when you get tightly coupled components, it becomes very difficult to innovate and to advance the system.
Absolutely.
Right? So you want to be able to say, okay, I can go off and make changes here and not worry about ripple effects, I'm going to break anything else.
Absolutely.
So it's a very key very part of our...
Very compositional.
Right, exactly. And the one thing about a loosely coupled system is someone needs to be in charge. There's someone that has to know what's going on, because this guy doesn't know about that guy doesn't know about that guy, this guy doesn't know about anyone else. So there's all these things that don't really know about each other. So someone needs to basically tell each component when it's time for it to do its job. And that, for us, that's the client core.
Okay.
The client core, when it gets this request, the first thing it has to do is obviously look up some internal metadata to say, what is this thing, and which app is really trying to be launched. Once it does that, it now communicates with our file system and tells our file system, all right, there's this package here, right, that's represented, a representation of this that they want to try to launch. Along with that information comes an opaque blob that tells it where to get it, right? In other words, on the network. It's somewhere out in the ether. It's somewhere out on the network somewhere. How do I locate it? Well, there's an opaque blob that the client doesn't you know, understand. The file system doesn't understand it. It just kind of comes along for the ride. The file system looks and basically does its internal setup like it needs to, and then it makes an upcall into the transport. And we spoke about this before, that this is very difficult to try to go, you know, originating in the kernel and trying to go up in user mode,
yeah.
But that's what we do. That opaque blob is handed off to the transport. Now, the transport's the only thing in the system that understands the network. It understands that networks come and go, you know, the world changes. This component here insulates the whole rest of the system from having to understand that there is a network and that that network can come and go, right? So that opaque blob can represent things like HTTP paths or HTTPS. It can represent file paths. So one thing we do support is just using the Windows file API, excuse me, for fetching these blocks. So it could be things like, you know, you're used to seeing \\, server name, you know, like an SMB path.
Sure.
Another interesting use of it is it can actually point back to the local file system. So one use for that is you can take apps, you can put them on a CD, drop the CD tray in, and it can still be virtual. It can still be low impact on the system and not break your system. It can still be instant gratification, but the bits will come off the CD. So this layer here can treat the CD the same way that it treats a network.
Excellent.
So we also have our own protocol called RTSP. We didn't invent the protocol. It's the real-time streaming protocol, which is a standard. We have our implementation of it. And any of these types of paths are all supported. And the whole rest of the system has no idea which is which. It doesn't have to. It's just this one component. Which means that originally we only supported this. Mm-hmm. Then we went in and added support for this. And then by that point, we were very good at plugging in different protocols that we were able to very quickly implement the HTTP protocol in our transport. The only reason we're able to do it is we had all of the supporting infrastructure in there, and we had a pluggable model, so we were able to basically plug in a new module, update effectively a factory that knows how to take the blob and instantiate the correct type of object, and it worked.
Awesome.
So, there was a lot of planning that went behind the scenes, but it was kind of gratifying for us to see it happen afterwards and say all that stuff that we planned for. You know, there was great value for the customer when it came around to leveraging it.
Absolutely.
So now that we're trying to launch Visual Studio, we got to the point that the transport has it, and let's say it's HTTP. The transport then makes a connection out to the server. And the great thing about this is that the server doesn't need to have intelligence. As far as the server's concerned, this here is a gargantuan JPEG. It's like it's Visual Studio. It's a four gig JPEG. The server doesn't have to sort of do any of the translation or anything. It just knows that you're going to ask for the 4,000th block. I'll give you the 4,000th block. You want the 10th block? I'll give you the 10th block. I don't have to have any intelligence out on the server to know what to do with it. And that's important. That's a key decision because, you know, I like to say that dumb scales. Right. The more intelligence you have to put out there, the more of a scale problem you have because you're processing
Absolutely.
Out in there. There's tons of processing power over here that goes mostly unused. This is a precious resource because, you know, we say that, you know, we want to be able to support like 10,000 users off of one server. You can't do that if you have to put a lot of intelligence back there. It's just not going to scale. So we keep all the intelligence over here. The other kind of interesting abstraction is that the file system knows nothing about this file format, which seems bizarre because you would think that we talked about this being like a volume, mm-hmm. and this is the file system for that volume, so it seems like they should have some relationship, but they really don't. Mm. This format here is optimized for delivering blocks over a network.
Okay.
This guy here is optimized for being a file system. And so this interface here mm-hmm. is where the translation happens. So the file system will say, okay, I have this file, you know, bar.txt, and I need the 12th block of it. It's a big text file. I need the 12th block of it. It tells the transport I need the 12th block of bar.txt. The transport then does a lookup in its tables and figures out that that is actually, you know, it's an offset of like 3 gigs inside this file. It goes and fetches that, retrieves that, and then tells the file system, there you go, there's the 12th block of bar.txt. And so this, you know, this layer here is really a very big abstraction, because there's a lot of different things that that are inherent in the system that no one else knows about. So it's just another way that we sort of try to limit the coupling there. An interesting thing about that is, in the future, if we wanted to, we could change this format very easily. So we could say, all right, it's no longer this, it's something else. We could pick some other format and say, now this is the format, and this guy will take care of the translation, and the whole rest of the system may not know about it.
So I double-clicked on the Visual Studio link. Mm-hmm. As everybody knows, Visual Studio has a relatively large number of dependent libraries that it requires to actually run.
Mm-hmm.
What's sort of the I can see her taking a lot of time for it to actually start up.
Right. So obviously there's some lower threshold. Mm-hmm. The key thing that we do is this is block based. This is not file based.
Okay.
Right? So even if it has a dependency on a very large DLL, we don't need to bring down that DLL until it's actually touched. And even then, we don't have to bring the whole thing down. Right? So the DLL is represented in our file as a whole bunch of small blocks. And you can actually choose the block size. You could make it 8K if you want. We default to 32K. We've actually found that the compiler is good enough. When you compile a DLL or EXE, it does a really good job of keeping the locality of the usage in similar parts of the file. So we found that almost counterintuitively, we tend to get better performance when we use larger blocks, like the sort of the sweet spot's about 64K block. And one of the reasons for that is, especially when you go out over the internet, this link here, people always talk about bandwidth. Bandwidth is definitely important. Something that in some cases is way more important is latency. So if you have a high bandwidth connection, but it's also high latency, you could get worse performance. And so we have to really balance between the two. So we make it block based, which allows us to reduce the amount of bandwidth that we need. But then we also don't want to make these blocks too small, or we'll have too many round trips to the server, and then that latency will become a factor. So the balance that we found is that in general, for most production software, 64K tends to be a really good balance between the competing forces. So your question as to, wow, Visual Studio is really big, the answer is, well, it's only as big, or we only have to bring down as much as it takes for that initial working set. And considering how large Visual Studio is, it's a very small percentage of it. I should actually check the actual number. I could look it up. But I can tell you that when I launch Visual Studio for the first time on a system, yeah, if I go and look at our GUI, it tells me what percentage of it is in cache. It's like 1 or 2% or something.
Wow.
Right? So it's a very, very small percent that's needed to get it up and running. Which makes sense, because a lot of it is all of those, you know, libraries that, you know, that some developers use and some don't. I mean, there are just so many different libraries that are shipped with Visual Studio. And we talked before about C#, C++,
yes,
you know.
Yeah.
Like, I write C++ code. So all of the .NET, like C#, VB, like all of those pieces of Visual Studio.
You don't need.
I don't need them for now. I do some C# code,
sure,
but typically when I'm launching it, I'm going to touch C++ code.
Yeah.
So that's the stuff that I need. And I don't even need the compiler yet, because I'm not compiling. The IDE's just up. I'm going to go open a project. I'll probably start editing. At some point, I'll compile. If in the meantime the compiler's bits have already made its way down, I won't notice anything. If they haven't yet, when I issue that command and say I want to compile my project, the requests will come down to our file system, usually in the form of page faults. So normally for things like code, EXEs and DLLs, Windows memory maps them. And it says, okay, this chunk of memory here is backed by this file. And so then the code just starts running, and eventually the instruction pointer gets into some new block in the file. the memory manager says, oh, that's not there yet, so it starts a page fault. That page fault eventually makes its way down to the I/O manager, which calls into the file system, and our file system says, oh, I don't have that block yet. Now, normally with NTFS, like with local stuff, you know, it's gonna turn it right back around. Okay. With us, there's gonna be a little bit of a delay because we're gonna have to make this up call, go out to the transport, and say, go get me that block, bring it back, bring it down, and finally we'll handle the page fault. Luckily, we do things like some read ahead. There's some other optimizations in there to reduce the number of times that we have to go and do that operation. And in general, you know, what we found for lots of applications, like Visual Studio is, you know, pretty much your worst case, right? I mean, it's just, it's so big, and even doing something like a compile can chew up a lot of different, you know, pieces of different files, and you have to bring a bunch of stuff down. But even in those cases, usually what we find is that, you know, if you launch it and immediately start doing stuff, your user experience might get a little choppy at first, but it smooths out very quickly. And within the first few minutes of using most programs, you've touched the features that you're going to use regularly. And after that, we're smart enough to continue to bring everything else down. So we have this thing, we call like a trickle download, okay, where we say, all right, you're using the application. Right now, we're not getting any page faults that we can't handle. So we tell the transport, go get the rest of it.
Cool.
And it starts bringing it down. And, you know, in the best cases, the user doesn't notice at all, except the very first initial delay, because we've gone ahead and got all the blocks before they even go and look for it and notice.
Excellent. Now, of course, and again, you cache this.
So absolutely.
You only have to actually make, it's only expensive sort of the first few times you use the application.
Right.
After that, it's basically on your machine, but not on your machine.
Exactly.
But it is on your machine.
But it is, but it's not, but it is. Yeah.
Exactly. It's very interesting. One of the things I'm thinking about is, like, I like the idea of sort of the service model. You know, it sort of brings software plus services to kind of a whole new level.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I can see this enables things for me as a developer. Because of this model, I could have databases, local databases that contain packages, such that I could run every version of Internet Explorer, every version of Visual Studio side by side.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even a problem. I mean, there's no conflict whatsoever. That's actually incredibly interesting. And the speed will be super fast because it's going to be local calls to data, to blocks.
Absolutely.
Very, very interesting stuff.
Yeah, no, I can tell you, we, you know, very early on, so we were part of that acquisition from a company called Softricity, and we had our product SoftGrid. And very early on, we have a product that we have both a terminal server license and a desktop license. And initially, we sold just tons and tons and tons and tons of the terminal server license. And it was really for a couple of reasons. One of them is part of this virtualization layer actually improves terminal server app compat. Lots of applications work fine on a terminal server for the very first user that launches them. And then users 2 through N, if they try to launch the app, it fails. And it's for all kinds of silly reasons. Like a great example is an application will attempt to take a exclusive lock on a file that it doesn't really need to. Or it stores information that's logically per user. It stores it in a machine, you know, central location. These kinds of applications just work when you put them in the virtualization layer, because we make sure that those two instances of the exact same application, running instance 1 and session 1 and running instance 2 and session 2 on a terminal server, they don't even conflict with each other. And then the other reason that we sold tons and tons and tons of terminal services is for the example you just gave, which is on a terminal server, it's great at first because you only have like one set of servers. They all look identical, and you start putting software on there. Then you run into a situation when you say, oh, some of my users need Office 2003. Some of them need Office 2007. Okay. Now I'm going to have two farms of servers. And one of them are going to have a bunch of software on it. They're all going to look identical, and one will have Office 2007, and then this one over here will all look identical, will have 2003. So now I have two what they call silos, which is two separate server farms, even though I really wish I could have one. For pragmatic reasons, I have to have two. And that works good for a while until you find an application that, it conflicts with some app on this image, and it conflicts with some app on that image. So you create a third silo, another server of farms.
Sure.
And so we found in our customers that the average number of silos was 4 to 5. Hmm. and then they'd bring an app V, all the conflict would go away, and then all these servers would collapse into one, you know, homogeneous farm again. Awesome. And typically, what the first thing they'd learn is they had way too much hardware, right? Because they were over-provisioning each farm, trying to figure out, you know, trying to make sure there was enough work power there, or horsepower there for each workload. Mm-hmm. And when you collapse it all back together, now you just have like tons of extra.
Absolutely, and I mean, the deployment story for like an IT angle of this is, I mean, obviously interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have 25,000 desktops and you don't actually want to install any software on them, mm-hmm. rock and roll.
Right.
They all hit one server, and all the important data that they need is stored in the file system
mm-hmm.
That does exist because it's a real file system, and so their data is persistent. People care about their data.
Mm-hmm.
But the application isn't on their machine.
Right.
But I do want to point out that obviously this is an executing process, and the execution is happening on the operating system, which means if there's a flaw in the code, it can still be exploited.
Sure.
Because you're not security software.
Exactly, we're not.
I just wanted to kind of make clear that it's really running.
Yeah, it really is. And so if you pull up Task Manager, you will see
it's there.
You know, msdev.exe, you will see all of those things, which means you're using the computing power on that endpoint device.
Which is great. Now, of course, I mean, but let's now talk about where this model, I mean, this is a great model for a number of scenarios. I mean, people don't like to install stuff on a machine primarily mm-hmm. because they don't like to uninstall it.
Right.
Because it's a nightmare. However, where does this model not work?
So there are certain classes of applications today that we can't virtualize.
Okay.
Normally, for very good reason. Like a great example is if an application has a device driver, right? So in this model, you're up in all these things are up in user mode. We're separately down in kernel mode, and so there's this nice separation and boundary that we can have tighter control over what this sees. When you're coming from user mode into kernel mode, there's basically a layer called the NT API. Anytime you're going to talk to kernel mode, it comes through here, right? I mean, it comes through this API and goes into kernel mode. So there's a nice, like, you know, it's a very nicely designed way for us, you know, to be at a certain layer and sort of control what this sees. If we had a driver down here, so let's just say for a second we say, all right, we're going to go off and by the way, we have gone off and done some prototyping. We,
I'm sure you guys have.
A lot of the people, you know, on my team are, they do the work for fun they work during the day and at night they have fun doing almost the exact same thing. So let's say we wanted to do a virtual driver. But we have a different problem now because, first of all, this is one namespace. A driver is really just like a DLL, right? They're actually built the same. This is pretty much the same. It's the same like PE file format. A driver is just a DLL that gets loaded into the kernel. And so this is one big shared address space down here. And the entire system relies on the fact that this address space is correct. If the system detects any problems in this address space, boom, it bug checks.
Absolutely.
You get that beautiful blue screen and your system is done, which means you now have to reboot and those kind of things. And so if we would want to virtualize this, we would have to, in kernel mode, we'd have to go in and basically start messing with the import address table of this guy. Mm-hmm. We would have to start lying to it. Lying to stuff in user mode is safe. Lying to a driver is probably not safe.
Now, listen, I would love to point this out, though. Now, obviously, as you know, there are a lot of drivers in Vista that run in user mode.
They're starting to move them up, yes. So
now, if I'm in user mode, I'm cool.
Not right now, because not for any technical reasons other than we just haven't implemented it yet.
Got it.
Right? So if we ignore this driver down here, right, there's this, you know, there's the UMDF. There's this user mode driver framework, right? UMDF, which is really a beautiful thing because in reality, for security reasons, for stability reasons, I'm not sure how comfortable I am running extra code down here that you know, the people that built this weren't expecting. And so I would much rather have my code running up here.
Absolutely.
Right? The thing that we don't do today is there is honestly a very, very, very nice API that they built, very consistent for the in kernel mode for reflecting the driver calls up into user mode, having the processing happen here and having the request go down. So we would have to do extra work, the same way before when I spoke about the fact that we have to put in code to handle fonts even. We have to put in code to handle COM or NT services. Well, we will have to go and put in code to handle user mode drivers. But luckily, we looked at it and did a little bit of prototyping, and it looks doable for us. And so we would just have to go off and do the work. The challenge that you get with drivers is that whole side-by-side thing we talked about. We're able to do that because of the virtualization boundary, that we contain the knowledge of the resources inside this boundary. These things here, there's a kernel mode component to the user mode driver framework that knows about what these things are. So the challenge would be, could we still do the side-by-side capabilities? And would it even be interesting? It really depends. I mean, if there's a piece of hardware out here, right? At a certain point, you're talking about a physical bus, a USB bus, a PCI bus. You're talking about some other bus on the system. And attempting to push the virtualization all the way down to there is probably a really bad idea. But it's also probably not, and the reason being is that even though USB is a common standard, each driver and piece of hardware get to choose their language. And it's a private language that's not, typically not published to the rest of the world. Okay. And so we wouldn't know how to sort of translate and virtualize. But on the other hand, some of these things may just be what are called software drivers, meaning that they're not tied to any particular piece of hardware. They don't directly talk to any hardware. A thing like maybe some of these software printer drivers that you've seen, where you can say, I want to print this file, and I want to print it to a PDF printer. And then what really happens is it just saves a file to disk as PDF. It's a very clever way of leveraging the printer subsystem to generate PDF files. That could be a candidate for this, right? So we could say, all right, well, maybe we would do something like that. But we just haven't gone off and done the work yet.
Sure. And again, I mean, there could be some interesting synergy between what you do and something like Hypervisor that could abstract away sort of the hardware part of the story completely,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, it's possible.
You could do some interoperation there.
Yeah,
this
we
is
have
incredibly interesting stuff, by the way. What about, so continue. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I mean, so clearly ways where it's not going to work, systems that require hardware drivers. Not today. Not right now.
Yeah, we don't do hardware drivers, but, for most people, especially in the enterprise, the enterprises are structured such that there are people that they call the platform team. Those people own the hardware, they own the operating system, they own all the drivers. Then you have the application teams, right, because there's a lot, like I said before, there's lots of applications out there, and the application team or teams owns the software. If they run into a situation where a piece of software has really any kernel driver, by the way, even software kernel drivers, they have to take that and hand it off to the platform team. The platform team then tests it, makes sure it's safe and it works with their hardware, meaning that even sometimes a software driver that has no intention to be affected by hardware is sometimes affected by hardware. Make sure that it's safe. They bake it into the OS image. It gets deployed out, and then the application team deploys the application separately. The driver's already there, and the application works. So for our customers today, when they run into a situation where an application has a driver, they typically follow standard operating procedures, which is extract the driver anyway. Then they virtualize the application, and then they push the application out through AppV, and the driver's taken care of by the platform team.
Excellent, man. Very cool. So developers, what can I build, on this? Would I want to use this to build something?
Well,
do you have that kind of?
Yeah. So I mean, I've been a developer for many years and worked on different pieces of software. And the big challenge that I see today for people is this whole software and services, right? Software as a service, software plus services.
Yeah,
these whole trends. And usually, what people have to do is say, step one, completely rewrite your application using all new technologies, using JavaScript and the browser and HTML, all of which are clever, but you know, they're just not made for the purpose. You know, HTML wasn't designed to be an application platform, right? It was designed for data. And so you have to basically simulate all of the rich functionality you get when you're writing, you know, rich applications, and have to fake it out and kind of pretend you're doing it through Ajax, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, there have been companies out there that have, you know, they're hugely successful products today on the market running on Windows as rich applications, and they're saying, we're going to go rewrite it as an Ajax application, and in 10 years from now, you'll have all the great features that you have in the desktop version today. Okay. And I say, you're going to invest 10 years of development, and when you're done, you'll have the same feature set you had 10 years ago. Well, your competitors may decide to just keep adding features and you know, delighting their customers, in which case you'll probably lose. Because as we saw with Java, and we've seen with all these different technologies, now it's Ajax, that before you can rewrite a very complex app, all the technology's changed anyway. Okay. In this model, you could say, all right, I'm going to keep my app as is. I'm going to keep all the investment I have in my rich application today. I'm going to keep adding features to it. And I'm going to use a system like this in order to make it a service and make it click to run over the internet. Because the interesting thing about internet applications like, you know, Ajax applications is actually the problem's deployment and impact on the system. Right? They're harder to write, because the development tools just aren't there. I mean, we have Visual Studio, which if I want to put buttons and everything, I drop thing, and I can then execute code, and I can use DirectX, and I can give a very rich experience with very little code. And the development tools back me up there. I can set breakpoints. It's very simple. They're trying to get there with Ajax and stuff, but it's much, much more complicated. I've tried writing some Ajax apps, and I was successful at it, but at the end, I was very excited by a very mundane interface. Like, you know, I could do very simple things. You know, my favorite example was the first time that, you know, you see one of these map programs online where, you know, you can see the map and then you can drag and the map moves in the browser and you're like, ooh, that's so cool. And I stopped and I said, no, it's not. If this was a desktop app and it didn't do that, I'd think it was a ridiculous application. Right, so our expectations and the bar is so much lower with internet applications that, you know, sometimes we start thinking, oh, there's some sort of parity there, but when you look at what you can do with like XAML, and you know, in all these technologies today, sure. you can't even approximate that in a browser. And so if I'm a developer, I'm going to write rich applications, and I'm going to let the platform handle all the rest, right? Because the advantage of the web applications is you can get at them from anywhere, and they start up pretty quickly, and they're not going to hurt the system. Well, you can get all that with a system like this, and you get to keep all the rich applications, and you don't have to go and rewrite your app on some technology that by the time you're done will be obsolete.
Absolutely, and further, this is an example where you really take, I mean, we're going to have 1,000 cores at some point.
Right.
Right? We're going to have a terabyte of RAM. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty much ridiculous, but who knows? We're going to have a hell of a lot of RAM, a lot of processing power. Use it, man.
Right, absolutely.
So use the client and the server, and the cloud can be these lightweight distributed services that provide blocks.
Right.
I think it's a great model. So we're going to run out of tape, but this is awesome, man. It's great talking to you. And I think we definitely have gone deeper. So thank you for your time.
You're welcome.